some football!
Oh, intermission.
No, it's halftime.
Here comes Beckett. Down goes Shaw. The ball is out. Arkansas's got it at the 1 foot line.
Blue!
Yes, sir.
Do you trust that I do not want to see you die here tonight?
Sir, yes, sir.
Blue, you're my boy!
You can actually feel Razorback Stadium shaking underneath our feet right now.
I don't want them to gain another yard.
Here's to God in football.
Can't wait. The next game, and the years to come, because victory is going to be habitual.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
So this Saturday, there's a game at Reynolds Razorback Stadium. Maybe you've heard about it. Arkansas and Tulsa, homecoming. Two teams that haven't won against an FBS foe all year or tasted victory of any kind since opening day. They're going to do battle on the field at 11 o'clock. So someone is going to feel just a bit better about their team at or around 2 o'clock in the afternoon Saturday. But one of those teams, only one of those teams, is trying to entertain the top transfer in the nation while hoping the stadium isn't half empty. When the schedule was released last year, how would anyone have known that the Hogs would be looking for a graduate transfer quarterback halfway through the season, and that that transfer has a good relationship with Chad Morris, and that transfer wants to play in the SEC, and that he also has experience on a national title contender as a starting quarterback? Well, here we are. So my question for you is the following. What is more important, the game on the field Saturday, or the impression left on Kelly Bryant? Or does Bryant really matter very much in the grand scheme of things? He'll only be playing 1 year wherever it is he decides to go. Well, my co-host is Ty Richardson. And Ty, I know you've got a lot of thoughts on this. I also know that you probably slept just a little bit more than I did last night. This was my sign that I could finally go to sleep.
Kimbrel comes to the set. Outfield a step to the right, the pitch. Swinging a line drive left field. Benintendi coming on, dives, and did he make the catch? He did! He got it!
The Red Sox win!
The Red Sox win!
I just went head over heels in my chair.
Joe just fell down.
Oh, wow, what a catch!
That is a great call by Joe Castiglione. His partner's Tim Neverett. Castiglione's been the voice of the Red Sox for a long, long time now. Once he fell out of his chair, I figured now's the time to turn off the phone and finally go to sleep. By that point, you were probably asleep by about 4 or 5 hours, so I think you're feeling a little bit better than me today.
Yeah, I am. I was in bed by 9, Phil. I was watching a little bit of the game, and just like, I can't stay up. I need to go to bed. It's kind of funny that that happened, because my first day working in Nashville in radio, one of the co-hosts, a guy named Joe Dubin, who does TV there, fell out of his chair while I was in studio. And he just heard this thud on the air because he's falling. And the other co-host is crying. Greg Pogue, who's really funny guy, is crying laughing. Have you ever experienced anything like that happen during one of your broadcasts?
I've fallen out of a chair before, just not in the middle of a call like Joe did. I've also smashed my finger on a chair at Palm Stadium just because of the way those chairs are constructed. And I had a nosebleed during a couple of the broadcasts. But I wouldn't say I went anything quite as far as falling down out of a chair with pretty much a national audience tuning in and then getting right back on the chair and finishing the call while letting everybody know what happened. That's the sign of a true pro. And if I fell out of my chair for this radio show, I'd probably break my wrist. So congrats to Joe Castiglione for staying healthy and making a great call. And also, congrats to Andrew Benintendi for making what appears to be the catch of the postseason so far, which is saying a lot because there have been some great plays, but that was a game-saving catch. You gotta make a split-second decision that you really don't even have a moment to think about on a play like that with the winning runs on base and a sinking line drive in the left field. He has no opportunity to think about it. It's got to be instinctive. And Andrew Benintendi, he's got that sixth sense that I refer to of just the knowledge of how to play the game in every area. He's a great hitter. He's a great base runner. And he is a terrific outfielder, as you certainly saw one reason why last night. We're all feeling some of that Razorback pride in October because of Andrew Benintendi last night.
No, absolutely. And Bregman's the one, former LSU Tiger, the one that hit it to left. And if that ball goes by Benintendi, they're getting at least two runs, probably three. And that game's over, and Houston's going to win it, even if they tie it, and then they'll just have momentum from there on out. So what a gut-changing play from Andrew Benintendi. I know I would be very skittish, and I would just accept the fact that, hey, he got a nice blooper single or a two RBI single and just pick up the ball and throw it. But Andrew Benintendi went all out, went head first and made an incredible play. Did you listen to Brian Anderson's call as well?
No. At that point, I was just logged into the radio broadcast. I know BA probably had a really good call, too, but he probably stayed in his chair.
Okay, yeah, he absolutely did. He had a really good call last night.
Runners will be off with a crack of the bat with two outs. Kimbrel deals. Bregman in the air, left field. Benintendi dives, and he makes the catch! Oh, what a play! Game saver, Andrew Benintendi! The Red Sox win on a spectacular catch by Benintendi in left field. Wow! What a game! What a finish!
Really was a tremendous game last night with Boston pulling out the 8-6 win. They're one win away from advancing to the World Series for the fourth time since 2004 and got a chance to win that series in Houston. Wow, yeah, it really was an amazing game last night. The Dodgers-Brewers game was entertaining, but nowhere near as entertaining or even as controversial as the American League game. That's something we'll get into later with this fan interference call on what should have been, what really should have been a home run for Jose Altuve stealing a couple of the runs away from Houston. And while A.J. Hinch, Houston's manager, will say that that's not the reason that Houston lost the game, they eventually did take the lead. There's no doubt about it. I think Houston got jobbed there by Joe West, the longtime umpire who made the call of fan interference. But again, that's something that we'll get into much later on here on Halftime. So let's get into the conversation about this weekend at Razorback Stadium, Ty. Kelly Bryant, how important is it for Kelly Bryant to come to Arkansas? Because you have a stable of what appears to be very talented young quarterbacks that are already here in Steven Jones and in Connor Noland. You've got KJ Jefferson coming in next season. These are very exciting, talented young quarterbacks. But would they be ready to get on the field next season and lead Arkansas to a successful year? You know Kelly Bryant probably would be able to get out there and maybe win a few more games than the others, but it's only for one season. So my question to you and to our listeners are, does it really matter if Kelly Bryant comes to Arkansas this year? Would that hinder any of the development for the quarterbacks, or could it help them?
I think it absolutely could help them. We had Richard Davenport on the Morning Rush this morning, and he talked about that he thought KJ Jefferson would be fine with learning from Kelly Bryant. I mean, this is a guy that helped Clemson get to a college football playoff. He is a just great quarterback in terms of just his athleticism. Not the best thrower, which I'm kind of curious to what, if he was to come here, how Chad Morris would develop him as a passer, but I think it would help a lot more than it would hurt. I don't think John Stephen Jones is the future. I still think that Connor Noland could use some tutoring under Chad Morris and company, and then looking at Ty Story, I'd like to see them go at it. Just Ty Story is more the tougher guy that's been in the system this past season, kind of see them go head-to-head. I think it absolutely is a crucial point for Razorback football this year.
And it would make a lot of, it would make a difference in the wins and losses next year. It would be what I think. And more wins, even with a 1 year quarterback, that has to help this team. Absolutely has to help them. And it's got to help the fan base too. So let's see. What do you think is more important on Saturday? Because you're trying to make a good impression on Kelly Bryant in a lot of areas. And some of those areas are scheme, which I think he's pretty fairly well aware of as far as Chad Morris and Joe Craddock's scheme. He knows Chad Morris so well. Part of it is the talent that he sees on the field and maybe a little of the knowledge of the talent that's on the way for the 2019 recruiting class. And then there's the stuff that's off the field that has nothing to do with the actual team that he'd be joining. Do you want to come to a school that may not have a very large crowd at all for a homecoming game? Admittedly, it's not against the sexiest opponent, but then again, there weren't all that many people at the game against Alabama. So you wonder if a player who's got 1 year left and has played in the atmosphere that Death Valley brings in Clemson, if what the atmosphere is like at the Reynolds Razorback Stadium this Saturday really matters all that much to him.
You know what? I'm going to get to my answer in a sec, but Kelly Bryant actually went on Bo's show yesterday, and Bo's allowing us to play a couple of clips on the show. So I'm going to let him tell Arkansas fans what he wants to see on Saturday.
I heard about the fans, man. You know, I've seen it all over my Twitter feed and my Instagram. Just seeing the atmosphere, you know, just getting a, you know, feel for, you know, the type of environment, you know, I'm going to walk into. And, you know, just I've heard so much about Arkansas, and I just want to see, you know, what all they have to offer.
Okay, Phil, the Alabama crowd wasn't great, especially the student section. That was really bad. And it's homecoming, so you should see a few more people that don't traditionally come to football games. It's funny because I've been to a couple significant events, and this is more basketball than anything, but the basketball SEC championship twice in 2017, 2015, and then I went down the NCAA tournament in Jacksonville in 2015 as well. And Arkansas fans, this isn't just in basketball, but it applies to all sports. They always complain that their teams aren't where they need to be. They always complain that, hey, Arkansas should be better because of this reason, because of that reason. But it never seems like that fans want to go all in like they expect the players to. And this is a key point Saturday. This is the number one free agent. I'm calling him a free agent because he's a quote-unquote free agent in college football.
I think that's a good term for him.
And it's the truth. And so if you want this guy, if you want Kelly Bryant to come to Arkansas and he sees 50,000 fans in a stadium that holds upwards of 80,000 with sitting room, he's not coming. He's not coming. And I know it's Tulsa, but it's homecoming, and he wants to see a ferocious crowd. He wants to see the atmosphere. He just told you that on Bo's show yesterday. Death Valley is a top 10 atmosphere in college football. Howard's Rock, when they touch that thing and when they're coming down, that is one of the more significant moments in a college football pregame. Now, Arkansas has the running through the A, and it gets loud. Greg McElroy's talked about how it's the loudest stadium he ever plays in. Show that Saturday. I know it's Tulsa. I understand that. But if you're going to the game, or if you're debating on going to the game, just remember this. I know the players and coaches, it's on them to get the program back, but there's a little ownership that fans need to take too, Phil. And it starts on Saturday, bringing in a good atmosphere, possibly getting the best transfer in college football.
Are you going to the game? It's 877-377-6963. Let us know if you got plans to go to the game, or if you hadn't made plans to go, if you are thinking that you may try to influence Kelly Bryant by showing up. Now, here's the other thing, too. Obviously, fans are trying to influence him because they're tweeting at him. I mean, that's what you do on social media. Certainly, recruiting Twitter is a little bit weirder than some other parts of Twitter. But fans are tweeting at Kelly Bryant. They're not just Arkansas fans, but a lot of other fans, too. That doesn't necessarily translate to people going to the game. And I think a lot of fans who pay close attention to the program knew that the Alabama game was a big recruiting weekend. I forget how many official visits there were. There's something like 9 and then over 70 other non-official visitors to the Alabama game. And yet you still had a crowd that was very small by a lot of other standards in the SEC and even small by standards at Razorback Stadium. So what would be the difference 2 weeks later when it's a single recruit, no matter how well-known he is, and the fact that he's a guy that might be able to win you a couple more games next year or a few more? I just kind of wonder if in fans' mindset, if they didn't show up to the game against Alabama knowing that, you know, you're trying to put on a good face for high school recruits, what's any different for their thought process this Saturday with Kelly Bryant coming in? I just don't know if fans necessarily view that it is it's their job to do the recruiting. But here's the thing. I mean, it's up to the player. It is up to the player what he thinks is important. Fan support is going to be part of it. But I think if you're Kelly Bryant, a bigger chunk of it is going to be who you'd be competing against, how you fit in to the scheme. And really, I think if you're looking at it in those aspects, Arkansas is a very attractive place for Kelly Bryant, whether there's 70,000 people in the seats or 20,000 people in the seats.
One thing Nikki mentioned earlier this week is that the coaches are really pressing on relationships. That's a big thing for this coaching staff as a whole, because as of late, Arkansas has not been a good football team. They do have some history, but compared to likes of Ohio State, Tennessee, Florida, I mean, there's certain schools they compete against that overwhelm them when it comes to college football history. And one thing that Arkansas has, especially Chad Morris, on a leg up on every other school, it's called relationships.
Very familiar. I mean, most everybody knows he was the guy that recruited me to Clemson. And so that relationship, you know, is real strong. You know, I've been talking to him. You know, it just seemed like we're picking off, you know, right where we left off, you know, when I was coming out as senior in high school.
So it's his recruitment, obviously, Phil, is going to be a little different. He's much more mature than he was in high school. He's a lot better of a football player than he was in high school. But that relationship still rock solid. And that is monstrous when it comes to recruiting, because especially if you're entrusting a coach with your final year of eligibility, Phil, you want to have a strong relationship with him. And it seems like, from all indications, Kelly Bryant still values his relationship with Chad Morris.
You're listening to the Halftime Podcast. Follow the guys on Twitter at PhilElsonPXP and at Ty Sports Radio.
And it's Joe Adams with a hurdle. Great speed. Adams down the sideline. Wow. He's gone. 92 yards for a touchdown.
Well, every time this time of the week on a Thursday, we scoured the internet for some ridiculous prices people are paying for things. You spent what?
How did I spend that much money?
You got a skull for your brain, a plastic sleeve for your comb, and a wallet for your money.
Are you stupid or something?
Thomas is stupid as a stupid does.
I'll even throw in season tickets for the Lakers.
You spent what? Ty, I changed things up a little bit for the things that I went looking for. I don't have any tickets today.
Wow.
I did not look on StubHub. I didn't look on any ticket brokers. Not checking out, you know, if there's $38,000 for an ability to stand on the pitcher's mound while Chris Sale is throwing, and a chance to get some waitress service out there to the pitcher's mound at the same time. No, none of that today. None of these are tickets. So I will start with a question for you, my friend. Fortnite, it's nothing that I play. In fact, I haven't really played like a video game on a consistent basis since the Atari 2600 came out in the mid-1980s. So Fortnite's the thing now. I mean, that's what all the kids are playing, and they play it morning, noon, and night. And there are professional Fortnite players. And here, I don't care if they're professional video game players. If there are people that will pay to watch people play video games, hey, then there should be professional video game players. Fortnite is where it's at, though, right? Do you play Fortnite?
I do not, Phil. I'm one of the few millennials that has never played that game, ever.
But you have some friends, though, that probably
get into
this.
Oh, yeah, John does. John does a lot. So, John, I would say probably 75% of my friend group plays Fortnite. But, I mean, I just don't have time, and I don't want to be playing a game till 1 a.m. in the morning and then wake up 3.5 hours later. So, Phil, I haven't played on my Xbox. In fact, my brother has it. I haven't consistently played Xbox since probably my sophomore, junior of college. The video game phase has been kind of ousted in my brain, if you will.
Of course, video games are now not a matter of, you know, bring the friends over to the house and get on the Nintendo or the Sega Genesis or the GameCube or whatever it was back then. Now you can play with people across the world, and that's what Fortnite seems to be about, and it's become the most popular video game in the world, to the point where, and I think John needs to maybe, now he's really good as a radio host, but he'll make more money, I think, as a professional Fortnite player, because there is going to be a Fortnite World Cup. They're calling
wow.
it the Fortnite World Cup, and initially it was supposed to begin in fall of 2018. However, they're postponing the beginning of the Fortnite World Cup until the spring of 2019, and maybe they're trying to find more sponsors. So get a load of this. If you the winners in the Fortnite World Cup would split a prize pool of $100 million. Now, there are some really crazy prices out there for sponsorships as far as sports are concerned. I mean, if you're going to buy a 30-second ad on last year's Super Bowl telecast, you're just going to plop down $5 million for something as simple as a 30-second ad. So the Fortnite World Cup is going to draw a lot of eyes and a lot of attention. So What do you think, if you're a company that's looking for exposure and promotion, how much money do you think it would be worth to sponsor the Fortnite World Cup? So the answer is $25 million.
Oh, gosh. 5 times the amount of a Super Bowl ad?
Now, I'm sure you get more than a 30-second. You better get more than a 30-second ad for $25 million. But that's the biggest sponsorship I've ever heard of before. So, I mean, you're talking about probably tens of thousands of players worldwide, if not more. Their eyes will be fixated on those screens for a good long time. I'm assuming that these partnerships come with a lot of time on the screen. You're going to make $25 million back on that sponsorship alone? I've never heard of anything quite like that. I had trouble selling $3,000 sponsorships for minor league baseball. Good luck with a $25 million sponsorship, although millions of eyes at the same time might get you that money.
Here's the thing, Phil. Even if, and I know there's some older Fortnite players, but I feel like the majority age group are teenagers. So even if you're a company or whatever, unless you're really catering to that age group, those kids don't have any money. Like their parents are the one.
You know what those teenagers have money to spend on, and it's probably what they'll use instead of, oh, I don't know, taking a shower?
Totino's Pizza Rolls.
Axe Body Spray.
He's going to
get a partnership for Fortnite World Cup.
They're happy.
Probably two sponsorships.
That's not bad. Jeez, at least. 25 mil? Wish I could throw that around.
That's a lot of body spray, my man.
That is a lot of body spray. All right, so the G League in 2019, this is the, quote-unquote, the precursor to the NBA National Basketball Association.
Used to be the D League, and
exactly.
Then what, didn't Gatorade buy a sponsorship of them for,
probably less than
$25 million?
I would venture to say it might be a little more, but we'll go with that. So these new select contracts that they're doing are worth $125,000 to elite prospects who are at least 18 years old but are not eligible for the NBA draft. So this is kind of, it's going to be interesting how this shakes up the college ranks, but $125,000. I was just thinking about that. They're just going to pay for a quick $125,000, and that's the lowest of low. That is the lowest pay amount that player will ever make if he ends up going on anywhere in the G League and then the NBA. That's the lowest amount. And they're just spending
$125,000 as the low amount.
Yeah, the low amount. So that just blows my mind. That's the low end of it.
So this is for kids that are going to go to college, but just for the 1 year.
So they're choosing to go to the G League, which would then make them eligible after a year to play in the NBA. It's kind of the new thing that's transforming the NBA right now. That kids are going to be, it's going to come down to decisions. It's kind of like, in a sense, you remember the ABA and the NBA, how they would choose to go to one or the other. This, in a sense, is going to, except it's going to be college basketball on one end and the G League on the other. And it might hurt college basketball. We'll see what happens. It's still a year off. But $125,000 just as the low end, that blows my mind.
That I wouldn't call that a low end of anything, honestly. That sounds like a high end for a lot of stuff that I'd be doing. All right, I've never been to a game at Marlins Park, the indoor ballpark that the Marlins play at in Miami. Now, when that ballpark was built a couple of years ago, that was before the Derek Jeter ownership took over. And, of course, they had a fire sale for the team and traded just about all their good players. And now Jeter continues to get his way, because have you seen this really ridiculous looking sculpture? It kind of looks like, oh, I don't know how to put it, like a rainbow on an acid trip out there past the center field fence. It's got the rainbows, it's got the flying marlin, it's got the flamingos, it's got the rocks all around it, and it stands about 80 feet tall, right above the batter's eye in center field. Well, Jeter hates that thing. Go figure, for a guy that came from the Yankees and was known for being all quote-unquote class, that doesn't really fit into to the Jeter persona to have some kind of crazy, ridiculous sculpture out there in center field. So they're going to be moving that sculpture to an art walk outside the stadium. Now, I don't know much about art and how you spend money on art or what everything is worth, but Miami-Dade County spent $2.5 million on this sculpture. The name of the sculpture is Homer, theoretically, because you could hit a home run into the darn thing and then it lights up and does its whole craziness after a home run or any Marlins win. Not that there are that many Marlins wins, to be quite honest. I think $2.5 million for a sculpture that was intended to be on television night after night and then being moved outdoors, that just seems like a lot of money to be spending. Plus the idea, now they have to take this sculpture apart piece by piece, and it's such an intricate piece of art, they won't even be able to get it up again during the 2019 season. I guess it takes about a year and a half to take the thing apart and then put it back together. If this sculpture is not where it's supposed to be by New Year's Day 2020, then the Marlins will owe Miami-Dade County $2,000 a day.
Wow.
$2,000 a day for not having your sculpture built in the proper place. That seems like a lot of money, too. But then again, I don't think there are a lot of ballparks out there that would spend $2.5 million on an ugly sculpture. And I know that a lot of people look at Cowboy Stadium, AT&T Stadium, as kind of an art gallery for the public. When you're walking around that stadium, there's really amazing art on the walls and in the corridors. But most of that is actually, I don't know how to put it, attractive art, instead of like a rainbow that threw up fish, which is what the Homer sculpture looks like.
Oh, man, that's a pretty good illustration right there, Phil. What that threw up fish? A Homer?
A rainbow that throws up fish.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, that either comes from a crazy dream or some ridiculous acid trip.
Probably a little bit of both. All right, so the Mega Millions and Powerball are up there. 900 million right now. 900 mil. So Tommy, John, and I were talking about, hey, where would we go out to eat this morning if we won that? And so John says a steak place, and Tommy kind of agrees with him. And I think to myself, well, first of all, I'd go get pizza.
If not chicken nuggets.
Yeah, or chicken nuggets. Because I will hopefully, even if I actually start making these, like, just gross amounts of money someday, I will stay true to myself and just be as bummish as possible and frugal as possible. But when it comes to, I was like, I wonder what the most expensive steak place is in the United States. So I was doing a little research, and in Las Vegas, the average per guest price at Cut is a whopping $117.
That's now, an average price for
a
steak.
Average price for a customer.
Let me ask you a question here. Is this steak lined with gold?
I would hope so, because I'm not paying $100+. I think I'd have to go back and look through all my credit card receipts and all my, but I think the most I've ever spent on a meal is no more than, if it was just for me, no more than $40. I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive that's the most I've ever spent on a meal. So to imagine myself signing a check with a 20% tip, because I used to work in the food industry, I know what that's like, unless the service is just horrible, I always sign 20%. To imagine dropping close to $140, $135 on a meal I can't fathom doing that, Phil.
I think there are some steaks where you can tell the difference between,
that's true,
you know, the $2 tough steak that's like shoe leather, or the $35 or $40 steak that actually does taste really good. But can you really tell the difference between like a $35 steak and a $125 steak? I mean, there's probably a lot of people out there that say yes. I don't know if I'd be interested in tasting that difference if I'm the one paying the bill. Here's what you got to do, Ty. You got to get yourself a sugar mama. A sugar mama with lots of money and a gourmand too, that's willing to take you out to Vegas and take you there herself and show you a really, really good time in more ways than one.
I need that. There's a couple of them in Fort Smith, so we'll do some hunting a little bit. I'll come back with some details in a week or so. How's that?
Sounds good. Well, I'm going to stay in the state for my last one here, and there was a couple out of Sheridan, just south of Little Rock by about 30 minutes, that won $3 million in the Arkansas Scholarship Lottery. You might have read about this. Timothy Burdess and Christina Vandiver. I'm not really putting a dollar figure on exactly what they did, but it was kind of amazing that they said, Timothy Burdess says that he was broke. He was legitimately broke, and all he wanted was a can of snuff. Just wanted a can of snuff. Found the change that he needed. He didn't have paper money at this point. Needed to go through his change to figure out if he had enough change. And look, I don't use snuff, but I'm imagining $5-6 for a tin. And he gives it to his, I think it's his significant other, Christina Vandiver, and says, you know, go take this, go get me some snuff and a few other things. And so that's exactly what Vandiver did. But she wasn't sure if she was supposed to play the Powerball or the Mega Millions. And this is a big difference because the Mega Million jackpot was $548 million, and the Powerball jackpot was, well, I don't know what it was, but it wasn't anywhere close to $548 million. So she played them both, and they got all but one number correct. They won $3 million on a $2 ticket and a $1 mega plier. So from $3 to $3 million, it's a nice way to increase your jackpot there. If they would have gotten one more number right, and this would have been the mega ball, the last one, the one that really jacks your winnings up all the way, one number away, and that number was 7, from $548 million, which probably would have bought them a lot of partnerships on the Fortnite World Cup. I'm sure they would have bought a couple of those sponsorships for $25 million apiece.
Should have invested. Yeah, Tommy was telling me this morning, because I just assumed that you'd get... I knew they'd take some of the lump sum, but apparently on the $900, they whack off like $400 of it immediately, and then you get hit with taxes. And I said, okay, well, why don't you just do it over time? Because he's like, well, you don't know where you're going to be in 30 years. You don't know if the Arkansas lottery will crash or the lottery system will crash. And I was like, all right, that makes sense. But even if they won the $900 or $950 or whatever it was, I didn't realize how much money is taken away immediately off the bat. So it's still a lot of money, but geez.
It's not the three. They don't get the actual $3 million, but you know the kind of a feel good part of this is that they said that all the money is going to go to. They both each have a. They have two sons. Both are autistic, so they're going to be giving all that money to their sons specifically, so that they can live proper lives. So that's actually a little bit of a feel good end to that story. And are you spent what?
Subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.
Trying to extend the play, and Brooks Ellis, pick six, will it be? Yes! How about that?
Bruce Howard joining us here on Halftime. Of course, the Hogs have Tulsa Saturday on homecoming. Bruce, thanks for your time. How's it going today?
Good, Phil. How are you doing? Good to talk to you.
Absolutely, doing very well. Really excited to have you on with us. So let's get right to it here. So I mean, Chad Morris was the offensive coordinator at Tulsa for one season, and that was kind of a springboard for him. He's mentioned that was the first college coaching position he had. Of course, he's turned it into what's been up to this point a pretty successful coaching career, and now trying to hit the Razorback football program going in the correct direction. What do you remember about Chad Morris during the one season that he was the OC at Tulsa?
Well, Chad was hired by Todd Graham, who, of course, has roots in Texas. And Chad, of course, as you know, was such a tremendous high school coach, you know, almost legacy coach back then. I think it was 16, 17 years and all sorts of state championships. And I think his last two teams at Lake Travis were like unbeaten. And Todd had actually asked him, I think, on two occasions to come up and be a coach, maybe not offensive coordinator, but come up and be a passing game coach or whatever. And he turned Todd down twice. Third time, though, Todd was a little bit more convincing, and so he came up in 2010 and was the offensive coordinator. And he really did a great job because the previous year Tulsa had not done very well offensively. They really didn't have an offensive coordinator. Coach Graham actually called the plays, and it just didn't work out very well. And so Coach Graham knew that he had to make a change, knew that he had to bring somebody in that was really creative and inventive, and obviously knew of Chad's success down in Texas. And so convinced Chad to come to Tulsa, and he was rousing success the one year he was here. You know, TU did really well offensively. And G.J. Kinney was his quarterback, of course, and G.J. is one of the assistants over there at Arkansas right now. So, you know, obviously he's done a great job. He's, you know, he's just one of those guys that you really like to watch in terms of the creativity and the different things he can do to stretch a team both vertically and horizontally. But he was just fun to be around, and you know, just a good guy. You know, we used to have coordinator meetings with him with the radio crew, and he was, you know, open and honest and, you know, really, really fun to be around.
I want to ask about not necessarily those meetings, but about how you were able to understand his offense, because last week Coach Morris was asked about how much of the offense has been installed here his first season. He said it's based upon the retention of the quarterback and how he's able to understand the offense. But he said that at that point it was only 30% installed, which I guess leaves a lot more for everybody else to learn. But when you were in on those meetings and he's developing that offense, did you find it an overly complex offense, difficult to understand? Did it take some time? What were your thoughts about the offense that Chad Morris ran?
Well, I think it was, you know, it's kind of funny. Sometimes, sometimes guys will say, well, this is a complex offense. And then other times they'll say, you know, this is a real simple offense, but we have so many things off of these five or six simple things we do. So I think they're, you know, they're vastly beyond me. Almost doesn't matter what offensive coordinator I'm across the table from. But yeah, his had some simplistic aspects to it, but it all revolved around the complexity of, you know, your quarterback being able to understand his opportunities or his options. You know what, you know, it's, I think you're right. I think it depends on how much the quarterback can grasp a certain offense as to how complex it can be. And so I think I'm not really answering your question, but the answer is kind of yes. It was pretty complex at the time because he had a guy that could handle it. That was G.J. Kinney that one year, and G.J. was a senior, and he had had two or three different offensive coordinators. He had seen a lot of things, but he was a sponge, and G.J. was really good at adapting to Coach Morris's offense. So, you know, I think you're right. It depends on your quarterback as to how complex you can be. And, you know, obviously right now, Ty Story is a junior quarterback. So, you know, he's probably starting to understand it and starting to really get it. And it's obvious. You just look at what they've done the last couple of weeks with 31 points against Alabama and 33 against Ole Miss, that Story and Kelly and the other quarterbacks are starting to get it and starting to understand it. So that's a long answer to a simple question, wasn't it?
That's okay. We like long answers here, Bruce. Bruce Howard's our guest. He is the play-by-play broadcaster for the Tulsa Golden Hurricane. Bruce, looking at the Tulsa-Arkansas series, I know you've been at Tulsa since the 90s. Is this the closest these two teams have been from a talent perspective since you've been at Tulsa?
No. Actually, 2008, I thought Tulsa had the better team coming to Arkansas. Tulsa was 8-0. They were ranked 15th, 16th, something like that. They were really humming under Coach Graham. Coach Graham had them going, and it was Gus Malzahn's offense. So, yeah, I thought Tulsa had as good a talent, perhaps better, and I thought their scheme was better. But Tulsa still lost the game, and I thought in 2012 Tulsa had as, I don't know, when you talk about just pure talent, no, Arkansas usually has better talent and better depth. But I thought Tulsa was as good or a better team even in 2012. And again, Arkansas won the game. So, but there have been a lot of years, you know, in the past, especially 2003, Tulsa came to Fayetteville and clearly was an inferior team. And it showed. But I think there was another game in 1993 where Tulsa came over. That was my first year of broadcasting, and I have never seen it rain so hard any place, anywhere, during any game, ever. It rained so hard for 3 hours during the course of that game at Fayetteville, and Arkansas won that game, you know, as well. And Arkansas was probably a more talented team than Tulsa that year. So I think in general, yeah, you probably should think Arkansas should be more talented and should have more depth. But there have been occasions where I thought Tulsa's had a really good chance to go over there and win. They just haven't.
So Arkansas's really fallen apart late in games this season, but Tulsa has too. From getting to watch Tulsa, what has been the biggest problem late in games for the Golden Hurricane?
You know, and you might think that that's defense because you're giving up this score and that score and losing a game by a point as they did. You know, they give up 15 points in the fourth quarter. But I think it goes to a certain extent to the other side when your offense is unable to stay on the field and wrap up games. You know, they're obviously Tulsa had a situation last week where if they just get one first down, the ball game is over, and they couldn't do that. You know, they couldn't stay on the field. So I think to a large extent, You know, when there's a comeback like that, some of it's on the offense. Some of it's on your offense not able to respond to somebody that's coming from behind and not able to stay on the field and get first downs and chew up time on the clock. So probably the biggest, you know, failure in that regard, yes, has been defense. Obviously, you don't want to give up late scores. But I think some of that has to do with, you know, Tulsa's offense having, for instance, this last game had 9 plays and 0 yards in the fourth quarter. You know, they had three and outs. So, you know, there's equal blame, I guess, when that sort of thing happens. And sometimes people forget it can be also your offense. It's not Hellman, you know, at that point in the, you know, at that point in the ballgame.
One more first down, Ty. Where have I heard that before?
That sounds familiar, doesn't it, Phil?
I know. It really does. It really does. You know, looking at the stats, Bruce, it's about a 2-to-1 ratio on running plays to trying to pass the ball. So, I mean, it looks like the Golden Hurricane really lean on Brooks and Taylor to try to carry that offense.
Yeah, they do, and that's partially because they have a redshirt freshman quarterback. You know, and even the starter earlier in the year, Luke Skipper, is a sophomore and still a little bit wet behind the ears, and so I think that's natural, and an experienced offensive line for Tulsa. So you're going to lean on the run a little bit and hope to kind of control things. Now, it's, you know, it's funny. Both of these offenses want to go fast. Both of these offenses, when they're playing well, play with a lot of pace, and yet I think for both offenses, they've been kind of stymied by, you know, the lack of experience, if you will, for Tulsa at the quarterback position just kind of slows you down a little bit. And probably the lack of familiarity on the offense for the Arkansas Razorbacks has slowed them down a little bit. But I think, when push comes to shove, both of these coaches want a pace. You know, they would love to have 88, 90 plays if they could. That's the way Chad was when he was here, and I think that's the way he wants to coach. It just takes time to get the right personnel to be able to do that. And when it comes to Tulsa, you know, right now with young quarterbacks, they're leaning on the run. But I don't think there's any question. If Tulsa's going to be successful, they must throw the ball. They must keep the defense honest. They must take their shots. You know, they got to throw it downfield a little bit in order for them to loosen up the Arkansas defense.
Well, there are a lot of similarities between Arkansas and Tulsa. The struggles offensively and the fact that you've got offensively minded head coaches that have had to rein their ideas in a little bit because of the personnel. So we know about what Chad Morris has talked about, the problems with the offense, but tell me about what Philip Montgomery has said about his offense. I mean, he comes from a great offensive background as an OC at Baylor and an assistant at Baylor and also at Houston. He's coached some great players, put up a lot of points as an assistant and in previous years with TU. So what does his offense usually look like, and it hasn't been able to install that this year?
Well, it usually looks like, you know, the fast-paced, get to the line of scrimmage, snap it as soon as you can sort of offense, and he just hasn't been able to do that as much. But it's interesting that probably the biggest misnomer about the Baylor offense, if you will, or the Baylor and Montgomery-Tulsa offense is that it's a, you know, zing it all over the field sort of crazy, you know, wild passing offense. And it really isn't. It's based on power. It's definitely a power offense as well, because they do like to run between the tackles, and they do, but they like to do it with pace. You know, if you get a big play, a 17-yard gain, the offense is designed for you to race up to the line of scrimmage, and as soon as that ball is set down, be ready to go. And it might not be another pass. It'd be a power run, you know, where a guy gashes you for 8 or 10 yards, and then boom, you've got all sorts of momentum. It's definitely a momentum offense. And so when it's running well, it's doing all of those things. And it's definitely taking its shots, you know, down the field to, you know, and if there was at this point room for improvement for Tulsa, it would be obviously the quarterback's got to play better. And the earlier quarterback, Luke Skipper, was turning the ball over too often. But the other part is the receivers. You know, the receivers have to get open, have to do a better job of getting some separation. And that just hasn't happened so far. So it's kind of a team thing. But, you know, at this point, obviously, as you've looked at the numbers, the passing game is the area where Tulsa needs the most improvement.
Bruce Howard's our guest. He's the play-by-play broadcaster for the Tulsa Golden Hurricane. Bruce, it's been a long time since Tulsa's been Arkansas, since 1976, 18 straight. Do you think any of the players at Tulsa care about that?
Oh, I'm not sure if they may know about it, because there's lots of media out there about that sort of thing. I don't know if they care about it so much. I think if these guys were playing every year and some of these seniors had lost 3 straight years in tough games against Arkansas, I think there might be a little bit more in their minds about that. But, you know, I don't, heck, you know, the, the last time Tulsa won, not, you know, I mean, I wouldn't imagine you guys were alive, right? No, I guess you, I don't know when you guys were born.
Phil was.
Okay, so,
41,
so,
I don't think I was.
So there's a lot of things that are, you know, kind of out of your mind at that point. If you're a kid, you're an 18 to 22-year-old, and you get to play Arkansas, and you know Arkansas is a great program, and you know they're in the SEC, and you know all of that. And you obviously know that there's, you know, it's a daunting place to go and that sort of thing. I think you're aware of that. But I'm not so certain you're so much aware of, you know, a rivalry situation, because truly it isn't a rivalry. You're not playing enough for it to really be a rivalry. Plus, if you're going to have a rivalry, you have to win more than one out of every 18 games. So, you know, that's the sort of thing I think is probably not in their minds at this point. It's probably us media guys and some, you know, people over in the SID office that have been here for a long time that are aware of it more probably than the players.
Bruce, we'll let you get on with the rest of your day. It's the shortest drive that you'll take all season for football, so it's a beautiful drive as well from Tulsa to Fayetteville. Hope you enjoy the game, and hope to see you sometime in T-Town sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it is a good drive, and it is an easy trip certainly for us, so I look forward to it tomorrow. I look forward to seeing you sometime soon.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. You're listening to the Halftime Podcast.